Hi, this is James Devine, and I am an educator who has come out of the trenches. Listen in as my friend and colleague Dana Goodyear shares stories and tips from other educators who have come out of the trenches.
Welcome to the Out of the Trenches podcast. This is Dana Goodyear. Thanks for listening. Coming up on 11 months of the Out of the Trenches podcast. If you like this podcast, please rate, review, and share on iTunes, Stitcher, and any of the sites where you download the podcast. It'll bring more listeners in. And also please share and promote on social media. Thank you.
My next guest is Dr. Markinya L. Williams. She is a Chicagoan with great Southside pride. She has been an educator since 2005 is an active member of the NAACP at NAN and a proud board member of the Illinois Principals Association, Burst Into Books, Inc., and St. James Community Church in Chicago. Dr. Williams has held multiple positions and titles throughout her career: teacher's assistant, teacher, grade level team leader, private tutor, preschool site director, technology coordinator, local school council member, PBIS coach, attendance team leader, MTSS co-coordinator, assistant principal, diversity and equity chairperson, CEO, and much more. Dr. Williams' personal mantra is expect, implement, transform. Her passion and commitment to public education has been the fuel for her success as a transformational leader. Dr. Williams strongly believes that all children deserve effective, highly qualified educators and committed leaders who believe in diversity, inclusion, equity, and justice. Welcome to the podcast, Markinya.
I am so happy to be here with you, Dana. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for joining me today. And, you know, let's jump right into it. Tell me about a time when you were in the trenches and managed to crawl out, and maybe what you learned from that experience.
So many to choose from. I've been in the trenches quite a bit, but I think the most probably transformational trenches story that I would love to share with the listeners, it's probably one of the more recent trenches experiences that I have had. So as you read the bio there about me, I've been an educator for a little over 15 years now. And recently, as recent as last year, 2020, I left my job as an administrator in the K-12 institution. And the reason that I left was because of personally experiencing racism and discriminatory practices. But aside from just my personal experiences as an adult, I saw the gross injustices that were being continuously done toward African-American boys in particular, but African-American children and students of color. I was a huge advocate of restorative justice. I did not believe that suspensions was the solution to correct some of the behaviors that we were seeing. And I have went into multiple rounds of conversations and attempts to change structures within this district, but it was not working. Mm-hmm. And it was really weighty on me as a professional. It was horrible, you know, going to work. I was crying, going to bed, crying, waking up, just dreading that interaction. And as an act of self-care, as an act of self-preservation, and knowing that my passion and commitment and my desires for education was bigger than one place and one space, I resigned. And the week that I resigned was actually the week that we went on lockdown here in Illinois. And so I sort of missed all of that end of the year transition to remote learning and all of that huge change and drastic change. But the trenches, it was difficult. You know, that was a difficult decision to make, to have a continuous cycle of meetings and to see that, you know, your superiors are gaslighting you on multiple aspects and to encounter the microaggressions. That was my first encounter with discriminatory practices as the only African-American administrator in that role in the entire district. And so that was hard. That was something that I had to learn by going through it. Yeah. All my life, I've worked in Title I environments, low income environments. I'm a product, you know, of a single parent household, a low income family. And so being outside of that element, no one really told me, you know, what to expect, or neither did I know that, neither did I have the awareness that I would encounter these things just for being who I was. I'd always been an advocate of, you know, promoting restorative justice practices. I've always been an advocate of making sure that our Black boys in particular were not ostracized, that we were not preparing them for the school to prison pipeline. And so encountering that resistance was overwhelming, but I am out of that. I'm on the other side now. And you know, I'm finding my way. So I'm working my way through the trenches. But most importantly, I believe that I'm laying a foundation for those who are coming behind me that will encounter the same issues that I encountered.
Yeah, and such a powerful story. And, you know, to have lived through something like that, where you're seeing, you know, when you're working in a school with the majority of African-American and students of color, and, you know, just the fact that, you know, they're getting high suspension rates. You said you were at the elementary school level, correct?
Correct.
And I was at a middle school that was similar with high suspension rates, and, you know, a lot of students of color getting suspended and even expelled. And, you know, I think we have that same experience of just seeing how, you know, we're trying to serve our students, yet we're kind of fighting against the system, right? And, you know, it has to come from the top. It has to be implemented from the school leader, the principal. It has to be implemented also from, you know, the school board and the whole the whole system, right? And if there's some kind of, you know, if there's a kink in the system where, you know, they're seeing this as being okay and they're not doing anything about it, then it's just going to continue. And those students aren't going to benefit from that environment where they're not getting the chances I think they need to get mentoring. So I think things that you're putting in place now when you're working with districts will help change some of the mindset, I hope. So talk me a little bit through your current work that you're doing and the firm that you started after you left around March last year.
Absolutely. Well, my idea was to get a job for the new school year starting in July of 20. And so I was applying. I was getting to, you know, the third and fourth round of various positions. And, you know, I just couldn't seal the deal, or they didn't choose me for those positions. And that was hard. You know, that was part of that trenches sort of narrative that was hard to fight through, knowing that essentially I was forced to constructive discharge. I had to get an attorney, just had to do so much to preserve, you know, me, and then to see that, wow, I'm not getting picked up anywhere, you know, and that was frustrating. I shed many tears. I'm a Christian. I prayed a lot and had conversations with, you know, those who I knew loved me. But that was something that only I can get through. And so I have Shirley Chisholm's book called Unbought and Unbossed. And one of Shirley Chisholm's quotes that she's most famous for is, if they don't give you a seat at the table, you bring a folding chair. And so I was at the end of June, in this predicament, like, hey, you know, what am I going to do? And what else can I do? So not only like, what am I going to do, but what else can I do? And so I thought of an idea to launch an LLC, a consulting firm. I literally sat down and wrote all of my skill sets, all of my experiences down, all of the roles I've had, all of the ways I have supported PLC, supported schools. I, you know, have worked, lived in Chicago most of my life, except these last 3 years or so. But I've done a lot in my career, and I've helped so many other people be great. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, wow, Markenia, why don't you put that same energy into creating a consulting business? You have the skill set, you have the capacity to coach. You're more than qualified, you know, to do this work, create a company around it. And so the organization is called the Panacea Consulting Firm. And the Panacea, the short version of what it means is the total solution. And that was a term that I used in my research for my doctorate. My research topic was called chronic absenteeism, the problem, the participants, the panacea. Mm-hmm. And so I said, okay, wow, let me just maximize this opportunity and bring my folding chair to the table and to create a space where school districts can reach out to me, individuals can reach out to me, parents can reach out to me to get support, to be a solution for whatever their needs are, from, you know, early childhood to creating MTSS programs, sustainable systems. I'm a huge systems person and a huge data person. So I always try to figure out where the data sources are, how we can use the data to inform whatever systems we're trying to change, and then create a systemic process so that it is sustained. In my experiences, I've seen a great program started, great initiative started. But when that person leaves or retires or moves on, so does that program. And so I have made it a priority to try to leave a systems footprint for whoever might come behind me, so that the children are not impacted because of my absence. Mm-hmm. And so that's how the Panacea was birthed. Obviously, you know, a new company goes through just that newness season. So a lot of the work that I'm doing, I'm building, you know, networks and relationships, and with, you know, the high demand for inclusivity and equity in not just education, but in multiple fields. A lot of my trainings and work have been sort of tailored to that need. Mm-hmm. And so I am trying to pivot that. And most importantly, not just for my business, but for saving student lives, to make sure that I am promoting equitable and inclusive strategies to school leaders so that children can benefit from that. Because I know the disparities, I know the inequities, I know how Black and brown children are treated, you know, different than their counterparts. And so now I have an opportunity to address those issues at a larger scale, because I'm not just in one place.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's what we need today with this, you know, systems wide thinking, as you said, like you were at the micro level trying to make change and you weren't getting anywhere, right? And then opening up a consulting firm, you're able to make change at the macro level. People that are seeing the need for a new way of thinking, or just more training around equity and inclusion at their school level, can reach out to the firm. And let's talk a little bit about how you got into education in the first place. I thought that was an interesting story we talked about in the pre-chat. And mm-hmm. you had mentioned that you actually, even though you came from a single parent household, you'd been in a private school. So mm-hmm. Kind of tell me about your upbringing from the lens of having gone through private schooling mm-hmm. and then now working in public schools.
Absolutely. So like you referenced, I was brought up in a single parent household, but definitely a village helped raise me. I lost my father when I was 7 unexpectedly. And so that sort of shifted the dynamics of my upbringing and the dynamics of our financial stability within our household. So, but, you know, I have no regrets about, you know, anything that happened, because it has made me who I was. So grew up on the south side of Chicago. My mom was a Chicagoan, a CPS student. And so she just had a strong passion for ensuring that my brother and I were literate. Mm-hmm. She came through the system. She has a degree in mathematics. So she's fine, you know, but she was also an athlete. So there's a special coddling that athletes get,
yeah.
That the average student, especially a student of color in poverty, we grew up, my mom grew up, you know, in the projects. I was there probably, I think we moved out maybe when I was 8 or 9, but she knew the vices, yeah. you know, that can influence the outcome of children, especially if, you know, they're quote unquote just average beings. Mm-hmm. And so she wanted to ensure our literacy and to make sure that we were literate adults. And so we went to private and parochial schools, the whole K-12 spectrum. I went to a Christian elementary school, and then I went to all girls high school for high school. And so my first experience with public schools was as a teacher, mm-hmm. but I wasn't planning on being, you know, a teacher. You know, I had an aunt that I loved and looked up to that was a nurse. She was a traveling nurse, so she, you know, would travel and she would make a lot of money. And so I love that, you know, and I've always been called to service. So I've always wanted to help people, but I just thought it would be as a pediatric nurse. My first job actually as a senior in high school, I was a intern at the hospital across the street from our high school in the pediatric ward. And I had the best job I think that anybody could have had. I would be in a lot of deliveries and I would be the person that would give the babies their first bath. And so because of the community I was in, a lot of the children were often substance abuse children who were either going straight into foster homes or some other unfortunate situation. So that meant that those kids would be there maybe 5 to 7 days, depending on how quickly they could find a placement for them. So often, because a lot of kids were having withdrawals, they needed to be held, to be comforted, to be consoled. So that was literally my job, was to wash babies up and to hold and mm-hmm. feed them for the 4 hours or so that I was there every day. And so I fell in love with that. And then I got into college and I met chemistry mm-hmm. and chemistry and I did not get along. And so I was not able to successfully get a passing grade to get accepted into the nursing program. And so that was another trench, that I needed to navigate. And I said, well, how else can I be connected to children and serve? And so the idea of pursuing early childhood came up. And I, when I taught, I was an early childhood teacher, and I fell in love with that, and the rest is history. So, mm-hmm. I was rerouted. Education chose me, and I have no regrets. Mm-hmm. So yes, that is how I ended up in the field in general.
Yeah. And I think that makes a difference. The fact that your mom wanted you and your siblings to experience, you know, getting a good education, having that strong literacy background. And that's mm-hmm. what kind of brought you into teaching, you know, the early grades and mm-hmm. that literacy, building those literacy skills. And I mean, was it a shock when you started teaching in public schools, having been brought up in the private schools, or how did you adjust in your first couple of years of working in public schools?
Yes, it was. So I entered the profession as a teacher assistant, mm-hmm. and I appreciate that experience because now when I interact with educators and or when I'm, you know, writing something, I have that awareness of including all of the educators that help make children who they are. And so I entered the profession as a teacher's assistant while I was pursuing my certification. And yes, I was like, oh, wow, this is what my mom was shielding me from. Yeah. And it wasn't the students per se, because I think that sometimes we put the onus on children for their behaviors. But yeah. as the adults, we are supposed to guide and instruct them. And so I just saw the gross negligence of the adults in the room who did not have the passion for what they were doing, who viewed children essentially as paychecks.
Yeah.
And so when you don't have a passion for whatever it is that you're doing, the impact that you could make is decreased and diminished. And so I just saw educators, you know, and I don't know people's narratives per se, but perhaps they were burned out by the time I met them.
Yeah.
Or perhaps they never had it, you know, when they entered the profession. I don't know the narrative of how they became who they are, but I saw just the chaos and the lack of consistency for, again, I worked in Title I environments my whole career, for kids that need it the most.
Yeah.
The lack of respect for children, the lack of love, you know, is missing often in communities of color. And there's high levels of aggression with children, So I said, oh, wow, this is what my mom was shielding us from. And I'm glad she did, not because I was better than the kids that I'm connected to, but because I probably would have came out illiterate. Mm-hmm. Below grade level, I probably would have just fell through the cracks. To be honest, I was not a scholar at all. You know, I was a C student up until college. I actually met a professor who changed the whole trajectory of even my aspirations within the field. And we're very close to this day. Her name is Dr. Murphy. I will say her first name, but actually I will say it to just pay tribute to her, Dr. Jean Murphy. And I met her, I think in my junior year of college. She was the first Black professor that I had that had a doctorate degree. And she would teach with just such excellence and just require us as students to be excellent. And her disposition was just exuded excellence. And just, I just never met a Black woman like that. And so I said, wow. Now, I didn't know, I didn't come into the profession wanting to be an administrator, wanting to even have a doctorate. Like, I was cool with getting a bachelor's degree. Mm-hmm. And so when I met her, I said, oh my gosh, I want to be like Dr. Murphy. Like, I want to command, she commanded your attention when she walked into the room, just her disposition. And so we laugh now, you know, post being her student, she retired years ago. But one day I was late to class, and I'm probably going down the rabbit hole, but all of this will make sense. But I was late to class one day, and, you know, we were late occasionally. And so she would let us in the room. And so this day, legit, I was trying to finish an assignment. That's why I was late. I have always worked full time and gone to school full time. So I've juggled both of those worlds for years. I graduated high school in 2003, went to junior college in 2003, and I've only paused a year between my master's and my doctorate, which was in 2014 through 2015. I took that 1 year off, and then I finished my doctorate in 2020. So I've been at it for a while. Mm-hmm. And so this day, this assignment was just taking me a lot longer. So I showed up to class about an hour late, and my friends were, I saw them, the door was closed. So the door was locked too. So I'm at the door like, hey, y'all let me in. And they was just staring at me, and we were supposed to present that night. And so I'm like knocking. And so then Dr. Murphy opens the door slightly and says, too late. And I'm like, what? Like, no, like, you don't understand. Like, you just see that I'm late, but for real, like, too late. And she would not let me in, Dana. And we laugh about it now. She vaguely remembers it. And so I just slipped the assignment on the door like, hey, I'll lose this 10% point for, you know, not presenting, but you're going to take this paper. You're not going to tell me I didn't turn my paper a time. And so, but she influenced me, you know, when I was well into my adult years. And I thought about, I had not had a teacher. I remember one of my first writing assignments I did for her, her class, and she gave it back to me, and she wrote A++++. And she said, you have a gift of writing. You need to really pursue it. Mm-hmm. And I was probably 22, 23 at the time. No teacher had ever said that about me, had ever said that to me. And that changed, when I tell you, the entire trajectory of my desire to be a better student, my desire to really draw out that talent of writing. That changed the whole trajectory. Again, I'd always been a C student, not necessarily because I didn't put forth the effort. I just, that was, you know, that was the average grade that I typically tended to get. Although, you know, I was 12 when I graduated from elementary school and 16 when I graduated from high school, but other factors played in place for those numbers. But ever since Dr. Murphy wrote that on my paper, I had been a student, A slash B plus student, the rest of my collegiate career. And I said, well, imagine if I had that encounter when I was in second or third grade or fourth, hell, even 11th grade, you know?
Yeah.
And so when I got to the public schools and I saw that that was lacking, I understood why my mom was so passionate about my brother and I going to a school essentially that would shelter us from some of those vices. We still had our own now private and parochial kids aren't angels by any means, but some of that is filtered out. And so I became relentless as a teacher with ensuring that kids left my classroom at the preschool level. I taught preschool most of my career. 85% of my kids left reading. Because I was very transparent with parents. I said, I don't know who your child is going to get after me, but I want to prepare them with the best tools to be self-propelled. Mm-hmm. And every year that was the story. It was a lot of work. And I would be open and honest with children saying, hey, you all, yeah, we're 3 and 4 year olds, mostly 4 though. I said, but kindergarten is coming and it's going to be totally different. So yeah, you are the block area and sand and water now, but you're not going to have that next year. Mm-hmm. And to really, I empowered them a lot with self-love, you know, affirmations, complimenting a peer, things that I just knew was missing overall from the environment of classrooms that I had the opportunity to interact with and teachers that I had the opportunity to interact with. And so my principal, he said, William, you should pursue, you know, being an administrator. And that's, you know, sort of how it all unfolded on top of Dr. Murphy. But I just think about if I had these experiences earlier in my life, who would I be now, you know, and how much further could I be?
Sure.
And so, yeah, it was, you know, again, it was not the students that was, you know, the overwhelming aspect of public schools. It was the educators. Mm-hmm. It was the educators. I can name count, and I won't, but I should, countless educators that I've seen disrespect children, diminish children, speak down to children, Black and white, you know, to be honest. So that passion stems from that place of being a 23-year-old having, you know, just received a positive affirmation from a teacher at 23. And so those are things that I put into place early into the lives of children that I interact with, because that was a deficit for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's so inspiring to hear that work that you did at that young level of students, right? And just having those positive affirmations go in and, you know, having that reading foundation at that level. I have a kindergartner myself, and he's just starting to read in kindergarten. But, you know, you were setting the stage, right? You were setting the early literacy stage of you know, them going on and not knowing especially what they would have after they had you in class, but mm-hmm. but at least giving them those tools at that early age. And I think also, you know, I agree, you know, there's educators throughout my career I've known that, you know, mm-hmm. Have not shown respect to students. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when we're not educators showing respect to our students, we don't get respect back, right? Mm-hmm. We're not, you know, when we're not building relationships with our students, mm-hmm. then that's going to fall apart, right? It's seeing the potential in students, right? And the fact that you really didn't get that like positive affirmation, as you're saying, in that A++ paper until you were 22, 23, mm-hmm. Is interesting, you know. And you know what could you have been? I think still you're, you know, you said you went on, you barely took a break. Mm-hmm. You sound like my sister, because she went you know, got her doctorate in 2012 in nursing, but you know, okay. She barely took a break. She got her master's in 05, I think.
Wow.
But you know, yeah. And so she didn't really take a break. And she was in school for most up until 2012, right? So it, you know, the fact is that even though it took until college until you had that positive affirmation from mm-hmm. the professor, you're still making the changes. I mean, you decided, you know, early in 2020 that you weren't going to stay where you were at. And that was mm-hmm. in the middle mm-hmm. of the school year, right? You didn't mm-hmm. know the pandemic was coming, but you know, mm-hmm. the fact that you're making changes as you go, you're mm-hmm. taking mm-hmm. those opportunities as mm-hmm. you see them and moving through, you know, being a teacher and then, you know, working as an MTSS coordinator and attendance teams, you know, those type of things that we're, you know, we've had mm-hmm. kind of that similar journey of mm-hmm. of being on those committees and seeing
yeah.
need at the school level, like with attendance, absenteeism, you know, working with kids in the RTI system and then becoming mm-hmm. administrators. I think, you know, we see that there are students who we need to support. And now, you know, the fact that you're doing your work with the firm is all the more kind of putting the rubber stamp on that. Yeah, you want to help mm-hmm. these kids. You know, you have that heart. I can really see and hear your passion about this. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about that research that you did. You just finished up your doctorate, you said, in it was that August or September of 20?
July, okay. June or July.
Okay.
So less than a year. So I'm yes, yes. So Sally May has not started sending me those bills, or not yet. Not yet.
No.
So I'm still in that era, you know, like I, you know, they're not sure if I'm coming back yet to school. So yes, so it was July, I officially got done. Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. So again, connected to, you know, my passions, and it's interesting how life goes. You know, I was talking to, who was I talking to? Somebody this week. I talked to a lot of people. But anyway, I said, it's amazing when you look up and you're operating in your purpose.
Yeah.
You know, I remember being a young teenager, early adult, a young adult rather, wondering like, what is my purpose? You know, what is my call? Why am I here right now? You know, why wasn't I born, you know, thankfully I was not born, you know, in the 1600s, 1700s, or why was I, you know, why didn't I come later, you know? And so I think us being here right now, is definitely for a significant reason. And so, because of my passion for, saving, you know, children and particularly Black children, Black boys, in particular, and I think I have a greater passion for Black boys in particular. I have four nephews. Mm-hmm. And so the kids that I see, I'm like, oh my gosh, what are their teachers telling them? You know, how is school for them? And so I love all children, but Black boys, I'm particularly like, oh my gosh, we gotta save them, because, you know, a personal connection I have with them and the young men in my life. And so my research, you know, my chair and I'm sure if she ever listens to this, she'll laugh. But we went through multiple topics, you know, and multiple just conversations about, you know, me wanting to save the world through my research. Mm-hmm. And she got to the point, she said, Markenia, she said, the best dissertation is a finished dissertation.
Yeah.
She said, save the world after you graduate, you know? And so she knew I was passionate about reading and literacy. Young children, of course, all children, but young children, their early years, and not just necessarily the years, but that foundational work that is often done, that should be done when kids are primary age students. Mm-hmm. And then obviously the passion for equity and inclusive environment for students of color in particular. And my desire to combat the school to prison pipeline. So all of those were sort of just things that had me going while I was taking courses in the doctoral program. And so again, with her, you know, advice of the best research is a finished, you know, project. So finally we nailed it down to talking about chronic absenteeism. Mm-hmm. So I went to DePaul for my doctorate and I was one of the few students, they just sort of changed the structure of their EDD program within the last year. And they added the capstone option. So I actually was able to, I was in the dissertation sort of track, but then the capstone option was a better choice for me because of the finished product that I had, which essentially I created an attendance manual or handbook. So my research is sort of structured in that way. But the topic of my research was called chronic absenteeism, the problem, the participants, and the panacea. And I told my chair, I said, you know, this is the back door to the school to prison pipeline, mm-hmm. because research has suggested, and we know as educators, but research has informed us that even if we don't make the reform efforts that are needed to change the system, curriculum-wise and other, if children just come to school, they're going to learn more than if they're not there. So without any major reconstruction, any more initiative, any school reform laws being added, just by having children in the school building, in the classroom, will help increase learning. Obviously, we know that major reform needs to happen, but primarily we need the kids to come to school. And when we do not ensure that these kids are at school, mm-hmm. the kids that are often absent wreak havoc on the same communities that were responsible for educating them.
Yeah.
And so, you know, essentially this whole absenteeism spectrum is chronic absenteeism, then you have the truant students, then you have delinquents, and then you have dropouts. And so either way, the community pays for educating or miseducating those students, because if they are, you know, juvenile delinquents, now the tax dollars are being fueled to pay the bill at the prison. Mm-hmm. So it would behoove us to educate these children so that they can be contributing members of society. And so that is why I was called to do work around chronic absenteeism, because I saw that this area of absenteeism was often overlooked and minimized by school administrators. Research literally that I highlighted talked about how school administrators always had access to chronic absenteeism data, mm-hmm. but they often viewed it as a mundane task or operational task. And they just didn't bother looking at the data or trying to fix that the issues of chronic absenteeism. Truancy was a little bit more tangible, and people have had a lot of truancy initiatives. But the main difference between a chronically absent student and or a truant student is that a truant student has only unexcused absences, mm-hmm. whereas this chronic absenteeism child may have a combination of excused and unexcused absences. And so because it takes work to pull back the layers of why a kid is technically excused, And a lot of districts, and through my research, I literally pulled multiple districts. I just literally went to district websites. One of the methodologies that I use is called document analysis research, where literally you look at documents and you sift through and you code it. And so I literally pulled multiple districts' attendance policies, and I was coding them, looking to see, number one, how easy was it to find the policy, which it was not. Mm-hmm. Number two, are districts defining terms for parents? Mm-hmm. Do districts have remediation efforts or initiatives embedded in their policies? And Dana, to be transparent, a lot of those things were lacking.
Yeah,
just in policy. And so from that research, I developed what I call, I'm changing the name now because I am in the process of making it a book. But at the time I called it an attendance action plan that had accountability measures for all stakeholders, from board members to the community member. Data collection processes and progress monitoring tools. Incentives at all levels, not just for kids, but for the adults. And so that was a proud moment for me because I felt like that my work not only gave me sealed the deal for my degree, but it really has driven just conversations that I'm having with school leaders that has opened my lens to the real work that needs to be done, starting with our policies. And so I hope that eventually in my career, I can be a policy influencer because of the critical lens that I have to sort of sift documents apart and to see where gaps are. And so again, the Panacea was part of my research and that's how the company sort of got that name. But the chronic absenteeism is something that I am passionate about because a lot of times when we have chronically absent primary age children, mm-hmm. It is hard to break those cycles of absenteeism. And because a lot of districts have lenient excused absence policies, if you do have a child that is afraid to come to school, perhaps because of bullying or because of the teacher's disinterest in them, then you also have parents that will cradle children at home. No parent wants to see their child crying every day. And often parents of color, just like the teachers and school members are not welcoming and open to the kid, parents feel that too. And mm-hmm. so now parents are saying, oh, you ain't got to go anyway. I don't like that teacher. I don't like that principal. They're mean. They're whatever they are. And so now we have this cycle of, well, we may say Johnny or Sally has an excuse, air quote, absence because it may be under this alleged medical umbrella. But at the core of that, our cultures and climates need support. And so that's just, you know, and I could speak hours about just the nuances of how chronic absenteeism really impacts not just the school community, but the community at large, because finding that data, tracking that data, it takes work. And like I said, for years, school leaders viewed it as an operational task. But the only difference why this is important now is because now chronic absenteeism is out of the 50 states, 36 of the 50 states chose chronic absenteeism as a SQRP indicator on their state report card. And so now chronic absenteeism is an accountability metric for 36 of the 50 states, and now it's tied to funding. So now you're seeing a lot of people talk about chronic absenteeism. We got to get a handle on this. Yeah. But the desire to rectify that was only birthed out of funding. So there's a lot of work to be done, and I hope that I am able to make an impact on the school system and really amplify this need for us to get a handle on chronic absenteeism.
Yeah, I think that's so interesting to hear about Like, as we look into the post-pandemic world, let's hope in the, you know, fall 2021, when, you know, I would hope most of the schools will be back in person, and we'll have that option for online schooling for those students who want to continue with the online. But, you know, I worked with a lot of kids as well at the middle school level who, you know, we do have that, you know, we have a lot of these parents who are excusing their kids due to these reasons that you said, right? And that, you know, once you bring those parents in for those attendance meetings, a lot of the time and you know, talk to them about the reasons, because I interviewed kids, you know, I did attendance plans and I interviewed kids for their, you know, they have the intrinsic and the extrinsic motivators to attend or not, right? And then I did the same questions with the parents. And of course, you know, a lot of the answers were vastly different, right? Why the student is staying home in the parents' mind versus the student's mind. And a lot of, especially at the middle and high school level, you're not going to have the students sharing all the reasons with their parent, right? So, you know, and I think there's, like you said, there's so much work to be done, but, you know, yeah, if it is tied to funding from the state government, then yeah, they might actually put the funds into the school system. But the thing is, like, a lot of school systems don't have somebody that's like designated to work with this, right? I mean, I was in a school district where at the school district level, they had attendance like a liaison who was working with seven schools. And in the past year, they had to get rid of that position. And they had a director of the attendance division, attendance and discipline division, who's still there, but then they had to get rid of the assistant director in the last year and a half. And this was pre-pandemic, they even got rid of his position just because they weren't going to fund those things, right? And those, you know, the assistant director was doing a lot of these truancy hearings with myself and, you know, people that were representing the schools. But I'm just, you know, as we look into, you know, schools going back in the fall, and as we go into, you know, the years post-pandemic, and yes, everything's going to look different, but we want to make sure that students are in school. And I think also parents having been home, if their schools were mostly remote this school year, will want their students in school, right? And, you know, but working with their, you know, school districts. And I think there's a big discrepancy between, you know, the want to have students attend and actually the manpower, like you said, that it takes to have somebody actually work on helping set up policies, either at the district level or at the school level, actually tracking these attendance issues, right? Because I was working on attendance and there was a lot of chronic absenteeism, but I also had a ton of discipline to work with as well. And, you know, with the students being suspended in that type of environment. So, you know, and for one person, you know, it's a tough job. So I hope that there will be more funding into hiring people at the schools and the district level into, you know, working. And this could be somebody who's on an MTSS team or team liaison. It could be somebody who's in a dean position. It could be, you know, there's various job titles, right, that where they have people working on attendance. But I definitely think, you know, if they have somebody who's maybe in a larger elementary school or split between two smaller elementary schools, but definitely at the middle and high school level, they need to have a few people working on this at each level, and then have district people who coordinate as well. And I hope as we look, you know, in the next 3 to 5 years of that becomes more of a priority, because like you said, this isn't going away. digging into the research, I think really it's seeing that, you know, it's not something that districts or schools are really visual. I've been on attendance committees at high schools where we'll put an attendance policy together that'll go out to the school, but it might not be like visible to the community, right? And the kids might have it, they might have sent an email to the teachers, but it's not like anybody else outside the school really knows about it. I think both of us are very passionate about this, you know, call to, like, let's get the kids in school so we can, you know, make that difference in the building and, you know, make that point. Cause we're not, if they have, like, you know, if they're lacking, in, you know, academically, if there are gaps academically, which there will be going into the 21-22 school year, if mm-hmm. we don't see them, if we're not yeah. able to work with them, then we're not able to identify these gaps. And the more that they're absent during the school year, the more that they fall behind, and you know, these gaps, it just snowballs. And I've seen that with individuals, you as well. We've seen these students, we can think of students by name. So I yeah. think, you know, this has been a great conversation, talking about just your work through education and now starting the Panacea firm. And out of everything mm-hmm. we talked about today on the podcast, what's one thing in particular you'd like listeners to remember?
I think I would like listeners to remember about me is that, and it might sound like a cliche, but that the children matter. And I'm saying that with the depth of caring for children. Mm-hmm. When children do not feel welcomed, learning can't happen.
Yeah.
To really make sure that your schools, your districts are inclusive, that children and families feel welcome.
Yeah.
And so that is something that drives what I do in whatever environment that is to care for people, you know, and not just in word, but in deed. Yeah. So that's what I would love the listeners just to remember as we navigate however school is going to look, you know, is to think about what I said about, man, who could I have been if I had had that experience that Dr. Murphy gave me 10 years prior.
Yeah.
Just 5 years prior, you know, how far that the level of confidence that was boosted because of that one affirmation and that one act of encouragement changed the entire trajectory of my professional and personal aspirations. So just pay it forward. Be sure to affirm children. And if you're not good for children, please leave. Mm-hmm. You know, and that is a strong statement, but I have seen too many people stay in positions because it's a paycheck, but you're damaging children by doing that. And one of the things that sort of pushed me to resigning, like I mentioned about the emotional toll that it was taking on me, and it was just not a healthy environment to work in. But I have always promised myself that I would never disrespect children by viewing them as a paycheck. Obviously, we need money to live, but that is not my reason why I show up. And so when I saw that I was crying going to work, crying coming home, that I hated what I was doing, I said, oh no, you know, I have too much integrity for this, and children deserve a better leader than what I can give them right now. And so really challenge yourself to see if you are, things are changing, Dana, things are changing in our world. Positions are going to be cut. Schools, states, the nation is bankrupt. States are, you know, in deficit. So positions are going to be cut, and more responsibility is going to come on educators. And yeah. so if you can't show up 100%, don't show up. like you know, because I have seen too many children's lives get ruined by people that are in positions because they need a paycheck. Yeah. So that would be my advice. Probably not the note you wanted me to end on, but that is what, these are the conversations we have to have, mm-hmm. because the work that we're doing now, especially when we want to talk about diversity, inclusion, I put the I before the E, so the people call it diversity, equity, inclusion. But side note, I believe that inclusivity promotes equity. So when we talk about diversity, inclusion, and equity, and we want to put sort of this onus on systems, but we got to think about the individuals. There are a lot of people from you know, janitors to superintendents that probably don't need to be in those roles, mm-hmm. because their attitude when they show up to work is not appropriate for children to view and to model after. Again, when I speak about educators, I am talking about the janitor too. I am talking about the clerk. I am talking about the lunchroom monitor, because all of us collectively help impact the educational experience of children. So we often, you know, just call teachers educators, but all of us within the school environment are called to be educators. So that would be my parting words.
Well, I think that needs to be said. And, you know, it's important to realize, you know, that we are going to have a tough, building back, the American educational system after mm-hmm. this pandemic pause, and, or, you know, we could also call it a wake up, right? It's given mm-hmm. us a chance to re-examine how we're educating students, and also really look, shedding a light on the issues around equity and inclusion. So, I think what you said is definitely everybody, all the adults in the building, they play mm-hmm. a role in those students' lives, and we need the right people on the bus, mm-hmm. as Jim Gordon said in his mm-hmm. books mm-hmm. are great, right? So where can people find you online and connect with you?
Absolutely. I'm on all the social media platforms mostly, but Twitter for sure. I'm probably most active on Twitter. So Markenya W, that's MarkenyaW. Facebook, you can find me Markenya Williams. Instagram, I believe it's Markenya Williams. I tried to keep them sort of consistent. And then YouTube, I launched a new YouTube channel this year. So yesterday I did the first episode of what do Black educators need? But I have other things on there too, but that is a series that I really am loving the vibe there. But Dr. Markenya Williams, and then, of course, the Panacea website, which is www.thepanacea.com. So reach me through those channels. My email address is on the website in particular. And let's connect. But thank you for listening. I hope that something I shared will inspire you to be great.
Well, thanks so much for being on the Out of the Trenches podcast today. It was great having this conversation with you. And you know, I hope people got a lot out of it. And I'll link all those social media handles and websites in the show notes.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Dana.